And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is January the 10th. 10th day of the new year. Only 355 days remain till this year is over with. Little bit of news. Bob Saget was found dead in his hotel room. They won't announce the cause of the death, but they've said no foul play is suspected and no drug use. So we'll see what comes of that. 49 BC, Julius Caesar crosses the Rubicon. That begins the Civil War. In the year 9, the Western Han Dynasty ends when Wang Mang claims that the divine mandate of heaven called for the end of the dynasty and the beginning of his own, the Qin Dynasty. In 69, Lucius Calpurnius Piso Licinius is appointed by Galba as deputy Roman emperor. 236, Pope Fabian succeeds Anterus to become the 20th Pope of Rome. God has spoken. 1072, Robert Guiscard conquers Palermo and Sicily for the Normans. 1430, Philip the Good, the Duke of Burgundy, establishes the Order of the Golden Fleece, the most prestigious, exclusive, and expensive order of chivalry in the world. 1476, Stephen III of Moldavia defeats the Ottoman Empire at the Battle of Vaslui. 1645, Archbishop William Laud is beheaded for treason at the Tower of London. That to teach you to disagree with the king. 1776, American Revolution. Thomas Paine publishes his pamphlet called Common Sense, something we do not have in Washington today. 1791, the siege of Dunlap Station begins near Cincinnati during the Northwest Indian War. Now, this battle took place over a two-day period between the Western Confederacy of American Indians and European-American settlers, what became the southwestern region of the U.S. state of Ohio. It's one of the Indians' few unsuccessful attacks during this period. Shortly after the Harmar Campaign attacks and the unprecedented defeat of the U.S. Army forces, a few months after the siege, U.S. Army suffered a major defeat at the hand of the Indians. Now, this small episode, a week after the so-called Big Bottom Massacre, what became well, now that Medicare is over and done with, dealers' service centers are calling about warranties on cars well out of warranty. But there are those that will line up to throw their money at them. 1812, the first steamboat on the Ohio River or the Mississippi River arrives in New Orleans, 82 days after departing from Pittsburgh. 1861, American Civil War. Florida becomes the third state to secede from the Union. 1863, Metropolitan Railway, the world's oldest underground railway, opens between Paddington and Farrington, marking the beginning of the London Underground. 1870, John D. Rockefeller incorporates Standard Oil. 1901, the first great Texas oil gusher is discovered at Spindle Top in Beaumont, Texas. 1901, New York, Automobile Club of America installs signs on major highways. 1916, World War I and the Erzurum Offensive, Russia defeats the Ottoman Empire. 1920, the Treaty of Versailles takes effect, officially ending World War I. 1920, League of Nations Covenant enters into force. January 16th, the organization holds its first council meeting in Paris. 1927, Fritz Lang's futuristic film Metropolis is released in Germany. 1941, World War II, the Greek army captures Klaissoura. 1946, First General Assembly, United Nations assembles in the Methodist Central Hall in Westminster. 51 nations are represented. 1946, United States Army Signal Corps successfully conducts Project Diana, bouncing radio waves off the moon and receiving the reflected signals. This is also the time period they started planning on a permanent base on the moon, which may well be there. 1954, BOAC Flight 781 of de Havilland DH-106 Comet 1 explodes and falls into the Tyrrhenian Sea. 35 people die. 1962, Apollo program. NASA announces plans to build the C-5 rocket launch vehicle, which became known as the Saturn V moon rocket, which launched every Apollo moon mission. 1966, Tashkent Declaration. A peace agreement between India and Pakistan signed that resolved the Indo-Pakistani War of 1965. 1972, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman returns to the newly independent Bangladesh as president after spending over 9 months in prison in Pakistan. 1981, Salvadoran Civil War. The FMLN launches its first major offensive, gaining control of most of Morazan and Chalatenango departments. 1984. The Holy See, United States relations. U.S. and the Holy See, that's Vatican City, we established full diplomatic relations after almost 17 years, overturning the United States Congress's 1867 ban on public funding of such a diplomatic envoy. After 117 years, I'm sorry. 1985, Sandinista Daniel Ortega becomes president of Nicaragua and vows to continue the transformation to socialism in alliance with the Soviet Union and Cuba. American policy continues to support the Contras in their revolt against the Nicaraguan government. 1990, Time Warner is formed by the merger of Time Inc. and Warner Communications. 2000, Crossair Flight 498, a Saab 340, crashes into Niederhassli, Switzerland, after taking off from Zurich Airport. 13 people are killed. 2007, a general strike begins in Guinea in an attempt to get President Lassana Conte to resign. 2012, a bombing in Jamrud in Pakistan kills at least 30 and injures over 78 others. 2013, more than 100 people were killed and 270 injured in several bomb blasts in the Quetta area of Pakistan. 2015, a traffic accident between an oil tanker truck and a passenger coach en route to Shikarpur from Karachi on the Pakistani National Highway Link Road near Gushan-e-Hadid, Karachi, kills at least 62 people. And in 2019, a 13-year-old American girl, Jaime Cross, is burned alive in Gordon, Wisconsin. Is found alive in Gordon, Wisconsin after being kidnapped 88 days earlier from her parents' home while they were murdered. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. I can't read this morning. I don't know what the problem is. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day. Benham, Sarah, and the 40 Martyrs in the American Apostolic Church. Gregory of Nyssa, Leone Aviat, Obadiah in the Coptic Church. Peter Orseolo, Pope Agatho in the Roman Catholic. William Laud in the Anglican Communion. William of Donahon. Fete du Vaudun in Benin. Margaret Thatcher Day in the Falkland Islands. And in the Bahamas, it's Majority Rule Day. Whatever that may mean. Okay, let's see what else we got. In regard to Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon in 49 B.C., he eventually was appointed dictator for life. until he was murdered by his friends. 69, Roman Emperor Galba appoints Marcus Piso Lucianus as Caesar. 236, St. Fabian begins his reign as Catholic Pope. 532, the Constantinople chariot racing green and blue supporters due to be executed escape, prompting the Nika revolt. 1356, German Emperor Charles I delegates golden degree. 1430, Order of the Guilder is formed. 1514, the Complutensian New Testament in Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, and Latin is finished. 1642, King Charles I and his family flee London for Oxford. 1663, King Charles II affirms a charter of the Royal African Company. 1731, Charles Farnese becomes Duke of Parma and Piacenza. 1801, William Henry Harrison is appointed the first governor of the Indiana Territory. He also went on to become the ninth president of the U.S. 1839, the first tea from leaves of indigenous plants of Assam in India arrive in the U.K. 1840, the uniform penny post mail system starts in the U.K. 1845, Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning begin corresponding. They eventually marry. Both were poets. 1861, Fort Jackson and Fort Phillip are taken over by Louisiana state troops during the Civil War. Also in 1861, U.S. forts and property belonging to the U.S. is seized by Mississippi. 1863, General McClernand's Union troops around Fort Hindman in Arkansas. Also in 1863, the January Uprising begins in Poland. 1870, Georgia legislature reconvenes. Nobody knew it had stopped, but that's neither here nor there. 1878, U.S. Senate proposes female suffrage. 1883, a fire at the uninsured New Home Hotel in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, killed 71 people. General Tom Thumb of P.T. Barnum fame escapes unhurt. 1889, Ivory Coast declared a protectorate of France. 1897, Ukrainian bacteriologist Vladimir Hafkin performs the first human trial for a vaccine against the plague. He used it on himself during the Bombay epidemic. 1900, Lord Roberts and Lord Kitchener reach Cape Town in South Africa. 1902, though its professed neutrality in the Boer War, German Chancellor von Bülow joins others in attacking the British Axis in South Africa. 1910, the first international air meet in the U.S. is held in Louisiana. 1911, the first photo in the U.S. taken from an airplane was done in San Diego on this date. 1912, the world's first flying boat had its maiden flight on this date, Glenn Curtiss in New York. 1914, Yuan Shikai, president of the new Chinese Republic, dissolves parliament, prepares a constitution of his own design. He's going to set himself up as dictator and then make himself emperor. 1916 began the Russian offensive in the Caucasus. 1916, in retaliation for President Wilson's recognition of the Carranza government in Mexico, members of Pancho Villa's Revolutionary Army stop a train, take 17 U.S. mining engineers off the train, and shoot 16 of them in cold blood. If that happened in Los Angeles, they'd be given a slap on the wrist and told to go off and be good boys. 1917, the Allied governments respond to Wilson's December 1916 note, giving their terms for ending World War I. 1920, silver reaches the record price of $1.37 an ounce. 1923, the last U.S. troops leave Germany. 1923, Lithuania seizes and annexes the country of Memel. 1925, Miriam, or she is known as Ma Ferguson, sworn in as governor of Texas, the second U.S. governor that was female, the first ever elected. 1925, the Allies refused to evacuate Cologne in Germany as agreed. 1928, Soviet Union ordered Leon Trotsky into exile. 1932, on this date, Mickey Mouse and Silly Symphony comics are syndicated. Then in, well, also in 32, we got Pete the Tramp, the cartoon strip by C.D. Russell, debuting. 1941, Sessenquart begins registration of all Jews in Germany. 1942, Japan invades North Celebes in the Dutch East Indies. In 43, the Soviet Union begins an offensive against the German 6th and 4th Armies near Stalingrad. In 1944, the first mobile electric power plants delivered in Philadelphia. In 1944, British troops conquer Mongdal in Burma. In 1945, the Los Angeles Railway with 5 streetcar lines is forced to close down. That same year, not a single soul was elected to baseball's Hall of Fame. In 1947, the British stops ships by the name of Independence and Ingathering from landing in Israel. In 1947, the Greek steamer Himara strikes a wartime mine in Saronic Gulf south of Athens. Of the 637 on board, 392 are killed. In 1956, Elvis recorded Heartbreak Hotel on this date. In 1958, Jerry Lee Lewis, Great Balls of Fire, reaches number one on the UK pop charts. Well, 1964, pitched battles take place between Muslims and Hindus in Calcutta. 1964, Panama severs diplomatic relations with the U.S. 1967, Edward W. Brooke, Senator, Republican Senator from Massachusetts, takes his seat as the first promptly elected African American to be elected to the U.S. Senate. And in 67, something I well remember, Lester Maddox was inaugurated as governor of Georgia. Let's see if it's anything else. 1973, a gas tank on Staten Island explodes, kills 40 people. 1980, James Garner's The Rockford Files had its last broadcast on NBC on this date. Well, let's see if there's anything else at all. And on this day in 1990, China lifts martial law imposed after the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. And I think pretty much that ends our little history segment. And I guess something that is well remembered in 1999 on this date, The Sopranos, starring James Gandolfini as mobster Tony Soprano debuts on HBO. Well, we've been talking about haunted hotels, and of course there are a lot of them. Also in Las Vegas, we have the Suncoast Hotel and Casino. It's a locals casino and hotel in Las Vegas owned by Boyd Gaming Corporation. It's located on a 50-acre site, has 432 rooms and 82,000 square feet in the casino. Over 2,000 slot machines. Has a Century Group movie theater, bowling alley, and a conference room and meeting space. Sometimes listed as being in Summerlin, but it's not part of Summerlin. It's located next to Summerlin. When it was built, the tower was the tallest structure on the west side of the Las Vegas Valley. Opened September 12, 2000 with a 5-minute, $75,000 fireworks show. Built by Michael Gogan's Coast Resorts. That's where it got the Suncoast moniker. Now, Coast Resorts was bought by Boyd Gaming in 2004. At the time, it was expected that as many as 90% of the property's customers would be local Las Vegas residents rather than out-of-town tourists. Bowling Alley is officially named the Swamp. And on our Skunk Apes visit, September 10th, 2007, been a lot of rumors about empty rooms where you hear voices, things being moved, shadows being seen in the hallways. But I can't find anything solid. Then we've got the Tropicana Hotel and Casino. The original building with the garden room wings was built in 1957. The Paradise Tower, consisting of 22 floors of guest rooms and suites, was built in 79 and it was called the Tiffany Tower, adjoining the resort's Tiffany Theater until March 28, 2009. It was the home to the Folies Bergère production show. Then the 21-story Island Tower was built in 1986. In May of 2006, Tropicana Entertainment acquired the Tropicana Resort and Casino from then publicly traded Astar Corporation for $2.1 billion in cash. Nevada Gaming Commission approved the acquisition November 17, 2006, and it was officially signed in December of that year. May 15, 2009 is reported by the Las Vegas Sun and Forbes, a Canadian investment firm, Onyx Corporation, take control of Tropicana Resorts and Casino in Vegas from Tropicana Entertainment when it emerges from bankruptcy. In 2009. Alex Yemenigian, who had previously served as CEO of both the MGM Mirage and MGM Movie Studio under Kirk Kerkorian's ownership, had been selected by Onyx to be Las Vegas Strip Resort's new CEO. Been a lot of stories about the Tropicana and some of the various things that have happened there. Needless to say, with its age of 1957, anything over 5 years old is old news in Vegas, and anything over 10 is history. Because Vegas routinely changes. Then we got the Union Plaza Hotel and Casino, now called the Plaza Hotel, was built on the site of the former downtown train station. Some say the showroom of the hotel is haunted by the ghost of a stagehand who committed suicide there years ago. Maybe regretting his final decision once the deed was done, he's said to hang around playing pranks on those who remain in his former environment. His hallmark consists of occasional cold spots, and people's belongings vanish and reappear in other locations. A few of those who work the showroom insist the restless soul's the spirit of Harry Houdini himself. And since the magic show held there is a tribute to Houdini's talents as an escape artist and musician, they could be right. Could be sticking around to make sure everything is done the way he wanted it done. Showgirls at this Fremont Street Casino, haunted by the ghost of a lighting man who killed himself years ago. They say he lurks in the corners of their dressing rooms. They see him as a cloud-like figure. And he tampers with the shows. Lights will blink, according to the staff, during performances. One member of the staff said she saw somebody in the lighting booth when she returned to the stage to pick up something very late at night. When she investigated, she found that the booth was empty, even though someone would have had to pass by her to leave the area. And Harry Houdini himself has said the mess was stagehands during Houdini enthusiast Dixie Dooley's recreations of Houdini's tricks at the casino. They've reported people shoving him through the curtains, but when they check, there's nobody there. Now, a place that I've always found interesting on the highway from L.A. to Las Vegas is Whiskey Pete's Casino. Originally owned by a cranky old gas station owner named Pete McIntyre. He was a small-scale jack-of-all-trades who was into a number of activities. According to local rumor, he had a difficult time making ends meet selling gas, so he resorted to doing a little bootlegging. And from this off-the-books business, he gained the nickname of Whiskey Pete. He died of miner's lung in 1933, and legend has it he wanted to be buried standing up with a bottle of bootleg in his hand so he could continue to watch over the area that had been his property. According to legend, his friends set out to dig a hole to hold an upright coffin, but gave up before they finished. So he's buried kind of, I guess you could say, sideways. His unmarked grave was accidentally exhumed when workers were building a connecting bridge from Whiskey Pete's to Buffalo Bill's on the other side of I-15. Body was moved at the time and is now said to be buried in one of the caves where Pete cooked up his moonshine. And a number of people report seeing his ghost wandering around the casino that bears his name. He likes to play with the light switches, knock over glasses in the kitchen, and he pulls off the bed covers. And there have been stories of visitors arriving at the hotel with their gas tanks on empty only to find their fuel gauges showing the tanks are full, and they get in their car the next morning, courtesy of Whiskey Pete. Whiskey Pete's was opened in 1977 by Ernest J. Prim as the first of the casinos to be located at what's then called State Line. 1983, a new hotel tower was constructed as part of an expansion on the property. They used to have a display of Bonnie and Clyde's car at Whiskey Pete's, but it's since been moved across I-15 to the newly designed Prim Valley Resort. You never know what you're going to find when you wander through these old casinos. Then we got the Mapes Hotel and Casino, the first major high-rise hotel built in this country after World War II. When the 12-story Mapes Hotel opened in the heart of Reno in December 1947, it was the tallest building in Nevada. And it was significant in the development of the tourism industry. It was the forerunner of the Nevada casino hotels built specifically to offer gaming, guest accommodations, restaurant bars, and big-name entertainment. The property was named after a prominent Reno family. The Mapes Hotel and Casino was the first major high-rise, as I said. Early settler George W. Mapes and his brother Ira ran cattle through the Truckee Meadows in the 1860s. After George died, his son Charles Mapes Sr. planned to build an elegant hotel as a monument to his late father, and that was the beginning of the Mapes Hotel. Charles Sr. and his wife Gladys purchased the old federal office building and post office property on the corner of North Virginia and First Street on the north bank of the Truckee River in 1937. World War II ended, Charles Mapes Jr. and his family decided to build their dream hotel using the blueprints selected by Charles Sr. and Gladys. Architects F.H. Slocum from Oakland designed the hotel while Theodore Moorhead, civil engineer, managed the construction. Construction began in January of 1946, but the shortage of materials after the war delayed the process. The Mapes officially opened December 17, 1947. Estimated cost to complete the hotel ranged from $2.5 to $3 million. Building was erected using reinforced concrete and a certain column and plate floor style of construction. None of the exterior walls was weight-bearing, with fire safety in mind, the rooms were built without transoms, and all the moldings, window sashes, and baseboards were made of aluminum. The grained hollow metal doors and the plaster-covered terracotta column walls were intended to contain any fire to a single living unit with a four-hour fire resistance rating. Hotel Casino building contained about 147,500 square feet, with the basement and first two stories being larger than the upper stories. First two floors of the exterior of the hotel were covered with 4x4 cream-colored tiles that resembled terracotta. Roughly textured red brick columns rose between the windows of the upper stories. The lobby featured the hotel registration desk and the three elevators with operators. In fact, no other structure in Nevada had as many elevators as the Mapes. The eight residential floors were advertised to contain 300 rooms as well as 40 suites, each with a living room, dining room, kitchen, bedroom, and tile bathroom. And three corner suites were unique because the corridor could be closed off and up to five additional bedrooms added to these suites. In fact, during most of the filming of The Misfits, Marilyn Monroe stayed in one of the corner suites. Standard guest room had a window and was only about the size of a single car garage. Rooms were each designed to accommodate a single twin bed that served as a sofa during the day. Don't know how that would go over today, but at the time, it was considered the height of elegance. The Sky Room, a cosmopolitan nightclub, was located on the top floor. At the time, only a few hotels in the country offered dining, dancing, and floor shows on their top floors. The Sky Room kitchen was capable of serving as many as 400 people at one meal. Lunch and dinner were served daily. Sky Room patrons had unobstructed views of the southwest sections of Reno, the rippling Blue River, the foothills, and the Sierra Nevada. Gaming was offered either on the main floor or on the top floor outside the Sky Room. Guests also had a choice of two bars for liquid refreshments, either in the cocktail lounge on the main floor or in the Sky Room bar. Provocative entertainment and famous show business personalities drew guests to the hotel. Few of the better-known entertainers included the comedic team of the Marx Brothers, singer Vic Damone, Judy Garland, Tony Bennett, Liberace, the burlesque dancer Gypsy Rose Lee. During the Squaw Valley Winter Olympics of 1960, Sammy Davis Jr. debuted as the lead singer with his father and uncle in the well-mastered trio. In addition, Charles Mapes sponsored sporting events to promote the hotel, such as the Reno Rodeo, golf tournament, and hydroplane racing. Well, in the summer of 1978, Mapes borrowed heavily for the expansion of his Money Tree Casino in North Virginia and the Sierra Streets. He couldn't compete with the new major hotel casinos that had opened that summer, such as the Sahara Reno, Circus Circus, and MGM Grand. December 1982, when Mapes was unable to repay the $15 million he had borrowed, the bank foreclosed, not only on the Money Tree, but on the Mapes Hotel as well. June of 1988, George Carradinas and Robert Maloff, partners in the Sundowner Hotel, bought the Mapes. Without having opened or improved the building, the new owner sold the hotel to the Reno Redevelopment Agency in 1996. In September 1999, the Reno City Council voted to demolish the hotel in spite of the objections of area preservationists and historians. Claus Construction imploded the hotel on a wintry Super Bowl Sunday morning, January 30, 2000. It was the first building on the National Register of Historic Places to be demolished since 1949. Now, the Mapes was a demure counter to the gaudy casinos down the street. Instead of beads of blinking lights running up and down its facade, it had concrete panels in bas-relief. Instead of a riot of neon on the roof, it had Art Deco zigzag cornice. Mapes Hotel was a grand beauty of a building prominently located near the Truckee River. In addition to numerous other attractions, it's long reported to be haunted for decades by an unknown spirit. After that hotel was torn down, that same presence has been reported lingering near the ice rink on the spot of the old hotel that's set up in the winter months. You know, the fascinating thing about the various haunted hotels and casinos, many of the stories of hauntings revolve around the fact that people come there just to blow off steam, so to speak. Now, from Haunted hotels. Let's go to haunted hospitals, sanitariums, and other institutions. Now, one place that's well known for being haunted comes from Alberta, Canada. The Charles Kemsel Hospital. Now, Jocelyn Chisaki and her friend Tara are walking through the Inglewood neighborhood of Edmonton, Alberta. Snow covered the ground, reflecting the blue light from the streetlights, and the only sounds I could hear were the squeaking of their boots in the snow. It was late. They were cold. They weren't happy about being out there. It was Tara who nudged her friend and said, "Hey, it's that old haunted hospital. Want to take a look?" Jocelyn said she didn't really want to and said, "Let's go." Well, Tara kept at her friend, said, "We're right here. Let's just take one look." Well, Jocelyn shook her head and reported she was gripped by fear like she never felt before. Refused to even look at the abandoned hospital. And even as Tara tugged her across the street toward it, she kept her head down, watching her boots crush the snow beneath them through a cloud of her own condensed breath. She was repelled by the empty building as much as Tara seemed to be drawn to it. And she said she didn't want to have anything to do with it. Just as they got to the thin strand of trees that edged the hospital property, a long, scary howl cut through the night. It came from the hospital. No question about that. And it went on and on. It sounded fierce, but Jocelyn had a definite impression that whatever was making it was in pain. Even as the howl faded away, Jocelyn whispered to her friend, "You hear that?" And she said, "Yeah, I did." The girls left that area as quickly as they could. Even Tara's curiosity about the haunted hospital had abated. But the howl haunted Jocelyn. Who or what had made it? She was positive it was something in pain. What did it mean? Why had she been so afraid to even look at the hospital? If she had looked in, what would she have seen? Whatever it was, she prayed that it might rest easy in the future. Years later, she moved back to her reservation and shared the story of her encounter at the Charles Kemsel Hospital with her father. He said that her grandfather, who had been a healer in his life, had passed away inside that hospital from cancer. And maybe it was her grandfather who just wanted to say hello. She said it was intense. To this day, there are times I wish we'd gone back, but we didn't. The original building that eventually became the Charles Kemsel Hospital was built in 1913 by Jesuits, and it was used as a Jesuit college for boys until 1942. At the beginning of the Second World War, the American Army took over the property as part of its friendly invasion of Canada. Several new buildings were built, and the resulting facility was used to house and support the American Army personnel and engineers constructing the Alaska Highway. When the highway was finished in 1944, the Canadian government took over the site and turned it into the Edmonton Military Hospital. They were meant to treat injured soldiers coming from the war abroad. Several of the buildings built by the American Army had been connected to the main building by a series of tunnels and corridors. And next, the government converted it from a military hospital to a tuberculosis hospital to serve the Inuit and First Nations group in Alberta, Yukon Territory, and part of the Northwest Territories. Royal Canadian Army Medical Corps and Indian Health Service ran the facility together for several months. And on June 1, 1946, the land and buildings were officially transferred to the Canadian Department of Defense to the Department of National Health and Welfare. A couple of months later, on August 26, 1946, the Charles Kemsel Hospital officially opened as an Indian sanatorium. But the buildings, like people, eventually wear out. In 1964, the government began construction of a new hospital building on the property. In July 67, it became the functional hospital, and the old Jesuit College building was torn down. The new building is one that stands on the property today. During its time as an Indian hospital, the Charles Kemsel was largely used to treat tuberculosis patients. Government-assembled teams would travel to remote indigenous communities to test people for tuberculosis, and if anybody showed signs of the disease, they'd be transported back to the hospital for treatment. Well, because tuberculosis doesn't discriminate in choosing its victims, patients ranged in age from the very young to the very old and every age in between. Those afflicted were taken away from their families and flown to a hospital far from home, and a large number of those patients didn't leave the hospital alive. Sadly, many of those who died at the camps never even had their bodies returned to their loved ones, leaving family with unanswered questions and without closure. Rumors of bodies buried on the grounds persist to this day, in part because the bodies of people who died weren't returned to their communities. In fact, the current property owners hired an Albertan historian, Michael Payne, to research the probability of it being a burial site. Now, he didn't find any evidence to support the idea, but that didn't stop people from wondering and speculating. And certainly, he couldn't have checked every inch, so it's possible bodies are buried there. Now, in the 1970s, there was no longer a need for a dedicated tuberculosis hospital in Alberta. So the council's function shifted to that of a general treatment hospital, and it functioned as such until 1992 when it closed down for good. It was officially decommissioned in 1993. Now, the old hospital facility is currently owned by Edmonton developer Gene Dubb, who's undertaken the long and expensive process of removing the asbestos from the building, with the goal of converting it into apartments and condos. Now, no doubt the long time that it's been spent empty has fueled the stories of ghosts and spirits lingering around the property, along with the rumors of booby traps and barbed wire-wrapped railings meant to discourage vandals and squatters. But given its emotion-filled history, you have to imagine these details are only gas on a small fire. The reported hauntings at the hospital, Edmonton historian Danielle Metcalf-Chanel says some have said that they've seen figures at the windows or broken in and had weird things happen to them. There's a lot of people who think their ancestor spirits haven't found peace and are still wondering about the property. For a lot of people, it just really was not a happy place. Intrigued by the rumors and stories surrounding the Charles Council Hospital, paranormal investigators decided to investigate it for themselves. They suspect they did find something because, as one of them made the observation, when you yank somebody out of your community and everything they know, there's anger, there's fear, frustration, and desperation. Add that to the typical high emotions associated with a hospital stay, and it's a recipe for a whole lot of residual emotional energy. And maybe something more than that. Well, the two investigators, Rona Anderson and Ben Micken, weren't 100% sanctioned to enter the Campbell Hospital, but they made friends with a security guard and he let them in. An outbuilding on the west end of the property connected to the main building through an underground tunnel, so rather than going to the locked front doors, they entered underground. I mean, frankly, I can't think of a better way to begin a paranormal investigation than climbing through an underground tunnel. After its closure, the Campbell Hospital is used as a set for a couple of movies because Dave Thomas's White Coats and Ginger Snaps 2 Unleashed were filmed there. Walking through the old hospital was something of a surreal experience. Some parts of it were empty and neglected. Others appeared to be still in use and fully functional. One of the first stops for these investigators was the old operating room. A few things in the room included a metal shelf and a light panel that doctors used to view x-rays. When they looked at the light panel through their infrared camera, it was glowing. No reason for a glow because it wasn't turned on, but it was luminous. Now, that may not have been paranormal. It could have been ascribed to an electrical short, even just an old bulb acting abnormally, as they sometimes do, but still, it was hard to explain why the light was pulsing. Intrigued by the light panel, they turned on an audio recorder and put it on the metal shelf in the room. They left it and left the floor. Literally, there was nobody on that floor. It was just the two of them in the building. They couldn't even hear mice. Later on, they played the recording back. They heard all sorts of things. The sound of movement, a loud bang like somebody slamming a hand down on the shelf. That was especially interesting since when they came back to get the recorder had been moved from its original position, almost as though somebody had hit the shelf and knocked it over. They also heard an authoritative male voice calling out the name Karen twice. They thought it might be a doctor calling a nurse. And the recorder captured the sound of metal tubes being shifted on a tray and clanking against one another. But during their actual visit, there were no tools in the room at all. Given the evidence they just collected, the two were convinced that there was something going on at the hospital. Made plans to return for an overnight stay. But on this trip, they didn't come alone, bringing a whole team of paranormal investigators and even a film crew. They wanted to record as much as possible and even make a documentary out of it. Now, some people take paranormal investigations very seriously. Some don't. The beginning of their investigation demonstrates it perfectly. Before the group entered the hospital through the front door this time, one of the investigators gathered them all together to perform a protection ceremony, a precaution that those in her group believed was important and necessary. And while she was doing it, the security guard who was letting them in wandered over. He stood in the middle of the group, scratching his rear end, and without warning, snorted, horked up a huge ball of spit and spat it out on the ground. That was when Rona, one of the investigators, said, "I guess we're done with that." Inside the capsule, the party split up into several smaller groups. The two investigators and one of the groups decided to begin their exploration in the basement where the morgue was located. Now, to get to the basement, they had to take an elevator. There were actually two elevators side by side, but only one of them was functional. The other didn't even have power. Now, the morgue was described as an interesting place. Still equipment left behind that they could check out, but on that particular night, the real action didn't happen in the morgue. Happened back out in the hallway with the elevators. While they were in the morgue, the little group heard the ding of an elevator and the sound of its doors opening up. When they looked to see who was joining them, it was the non-operational elevator, the one that didn't have power, that was reacting. Its doors had opened up. Intrigued, they approached, intending to get in the elevator to see what was going on, but as they got near the doors, they closed again and the elevator started to go up. Now remember, it had no passenger and no power, but it was moving. One of the investigators made the comment, "Wonder where we'd have ended up if we'd have gotten in it." At another point in the visit, when one of their group was on the fourth floor, they heard really loud footsteps above them. First, they thought it might be one of their own party walking on the floor above, but then they realized the normal everyday footsteps didn't carry that clearly from the floor above. Another area of the hospital where they expected paranormal activity was the former psych ward, so that was their next destination. And they weren't disappointed, though everybody had a different experience. In particular, one of the investigators had a profound experience because she says, "I can see spirits who haven't crossed over. I can't unfortunately say I see your grandma, and this is what your grandma says. I see the things that haven't crossed over, and a lot of them aren't very pretty, and a lot of them are angry. They're trying to be frightening." Not everybody in the group claimed psychic abilities of any kind, but even so, they all had a chilling experience in that part of the hospital. In the old psych ward, there were office areas separated from the main ward by plexiglass windows. When they wandered through that area, somebody in the group noticed something he thought was new and asked, "Were those handprints there before?" When they looked, everybody could see handprints streaking down the windows. Looked as somebody had banged open palms against the glass and pulled them down the length of the pane. Unfortunately, nobody could remember if the handprints had been there when they first arrived on the floor or not. But it was a disconcerting experience that put several members of the team on edge. It was about this time in the visit that some of the investigators could smell unexplained pipe or cigar smoke. When the investigators made the comment, we were kind of arguing about if it was pipe or cigar, but cigars smell nasty where pipes are more pleasant. He said, "I smell cigar," but some said it was definitely a pipe. It's also on that floor that when the investigator saw the first visible manifestation she encountered on the investigation, she encountered a 15-year-old girl with an incredible amount of emotional pain. Now, she said the girl was dressed in a hospital gown, but the impression was she was from the late 1970s. Caucasian girl with long brown hair occasionally obscured her face as she moved and hung her head. Her wrists were wrapped because she tried unsuccessfully to commit suicide, and she was twitching, scratching herself, creating deep welts, like a meth addict, but she wasn't a meth addict. She kept asking, when are Mom and Dad coming to pick me up? All she wanted was for her parents to come and get her to take her away from this place. At first, she seemed to think the little group of investigators could help her, and she hung around for a bit, shaking and scratching and asking when her parents were coming to get her. Eventually, presumably when she realized only one of them could see her, and that nobody had the power to help her at that time, she just faded away. Now, the investigator couldn't say if the girl died at the hospital or if she died elsewhere, but felt that her place was at the Charles Castle. Either way, it seemed pretty clear she didn't want to be there any longer, and yet she couldn't move on. Many of the team investigators, even those who couldn't see the girl, were uncomfortable on that floor and wanted to leave. In fact, most of them did go someplace else, leaving only a trio of people in the psych ward. Investigators split up into three groups. The first remained on the psych ward, and two others went elsewhere. And that's when the walkie-talkies began to act up. Suddenly, everybody in the various investigative groups heard an unearthly scream of pain or horror coming through the walkie-talkies. Before they could process the ramifications of that or try to ascertain its source, a voice came on and said, "Leslie, are you there? Are you okay? Leslie, where are you?" Well, Leslie was the name of his girlfriend. His name was Darren. And so it might not seem unreasonable. He didn't want to make sure she was all right except for three things. First, Leslie wasn't on the grounds of the hospital. She wasn't even in the country. She was on a humanitarian mission as a nurse in Africa. Second, some people heard his voice come over the walkie-talkies and others heard only silence. And third, Darren didn't have a walkie-talkie. Well, one of the investigators explained that they'll mimic you, speaking of the spirits who linger at these places. If he really was a spirit mimicking Darren's voice, that begs the question, what was the purpose it was trying to achieve? And how did it know what name to use? That does raise some very, very interesting questions. And on that note, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.